I too would like to express my gratitude to the organizers for the invitation, for the endless work which went into this event, you know, working relentlessly, not only behind the scenes, but also in the run-ups to this conference. So this is really a rare occasion. And I think the results are really tremendously impressive. So really sterling work, also including, but not limited, the film works. I'm a practical philosopher, and I'm not exactly directly related to Varocki and the films per se. However, when I received the invitation, I thought it's quite befitting. So it ties in neatly. What I do as a social philosopher and dealing with pathologies of work actually led me to workshops, to hold workshops on the social philosophy of work, and sooner or later quote Varocki just by way of comparison in order to anchor my own debate, create a kind of backdrop for the interpretation, a backdrop for associations for my students. So I really appreciate the topic of today's conference, thinking about work with Varocki. I feel very much at home here. So there's a twofold sense. Dietrich Dietrichsen mentioned the fact that there's a twofold sense in German when it comes to Einstellung. Einstellung means both attitude and shot. But I'm not going to talk about the filmic shots, but I'm going to talk about our normative attitudes with regard to work, be it in society or personally. And, you know, therefore, devotion, accuracy, and vocation is something which I'm going to discuss from a different angle, i.e., I'm going to discuss what happens if this very essence is endangered, if our capacity to find devotion in social labor processes, acquire accuracy, or see a kind of vocation in our danger. So what happens if there is an impairment of these faculties? I'm going to discuss lessons which we can learn from this negative developments, the pathologies of work, and what this means for our definition of what's good work, what our expectations for work, and what we can quite rightly expect from work. In my first part, I'm going to break my presentation down into two different parts. I will try and stick to the time slot which has been accorded me. I'm going to discuss two theories and problems from the overall context, i.e. what is work? What can pathologies of work be? Because one is a theory, and it's a discussion of the fact of alienated work. And my theory is that alienated work is being replaced, that work can also be alienated work, so we should detach it from conventional images which very often come to mind when we think about this, where it's an ideal of craftsmen and artists, etc. And the second theory which I'm going to posit is a very constructive one. It says that we can understand very succinctly what work can be, what work is, but also what certain pathologies of work are, i.e. what are bad deficit-based work relations. I mean, Hegel said that work is a kind of participation in the global or in the public pool of resources. This is what I'm going to discuss in the second part, but I'm also going to move to the mezzanine level, and I'm going to discuss what is the intrinsic characteristic of work. Well, rethinking alienated work, coming up with a redefinition with work and moving away to the, from a classical pathology definition. Not every work is good work, and sometimes we can also have problems with regard to work, namely exactly problems with regard to vocation and dedication. My theory is the following. First of all, we need to divorce alienation from one of the standard situations. What do I mean by standard situation of alienations? Well, It's what was entered very classically into, and also Marx in his analysis of the alienated work discussed this, but it's not so typical for Marx that he understood alienation like this. Well, it's alienated work, which in our classic standard understanding is characterized as follows. Alienated work is repetitive, it's fragmented. It kills your spirit, your intellect, monotonous. It's unqualified work. Impoverished, meaningless activities present themselves as decreased deficit participation in social skills, but also the non-existing scope and creative options that can be seen as deficit in the appropriate mode of the general pool of resources. So what you know definitely in terms of alienated work, well, you can't really realize your full potential when it comes to alienated work. What you need to realize your full potential is not the skills or the vocation which was mentioned here in the title, nor can you use this work. And maybe that's one of the best characterizations of alienated work. So alienated work is a work which makes it impossible to identify with it. So it renders vocation impossible, renders dedication impossible. I think this is giving short shrift to a pathology diagnosis of work. But nevertheless, we should keep it in the back of our minds when we think about what work should be, what we should expect from it. So it's a restriction. We are thinking about craftsmen, accuracy, etc. This is what was also shown in the films here. People who were very dedicated, very focused, and they had very specific skills and were capable of working on a product, of manufacturing something. This is a kind of ideal of the artist, of the artisan, of successful working relations, and then eventually this leads to a kind of holistic work. Non-alienated work is supposed to be a work where we kind of have a holistic attitude towards the work process, the production of the product, and where we have everything, you know, in one single shop. Nevertheless, this does not seem to be possible for industrialized work, which is based on the division of labor. Well, we've got to the instrumental activity, producing a product which you're supposed to recognize again, but it also means, and this is also what we saw in a couple of the films here, it's also visible in the industrial production process. Nevertheless, it's a kind of a fascination of what was mentioned this morning, man-machine interface. It's a fascination for the activities, a kind of interwoven entanglement of different activities beyond monotony. It creates a certain admiration of how things just fit, how they work out, how they work in their fit, in their congruence. There is a kind, or the complementarity, there is a division of labor if you look at various work processes, and you see devotion, you see competence and skills. So it's not possible to say that this is something that does not lend itself towards realization of one's own potential in the work process. It is confining the work definition too much if we only look to craftsmanship activities which are only related to these kind of skills. And it's a too restricted normative ideal of successful work. As I said before, if I'm saying this is a restricted view, then I'm kind of preempting something that will become increasingly important when we talk about the participation in the global, in the general, in the public pool of resources. In the tool, this is reflected, this becomes materialized. But let's now talk about the problems with the standard situation of alienation, which was just mentioned a minute ago. Inter alia, And many of you are familiar with this. There is the problem that under new working conditions of self-entrepreneurship, it's no longer to do with the fact that there is not enough scope for identification with the work, or that the problem tends to be that there is an over-identification with the work. People are obsessed, kind of, with their work. They see something as their own baby, their own project, and they really kind of put their heart, pour their heart in it. So suddenly work processes become charged with this imaginary pool of creativity. And this is something which many of you will be familiar with, I'm sure. Having said that, I think there's also another problem in defining work beyond the working relations which we locate in the creative industries, which is very often taken to define the work. So beyond the creative industry, you have a social situation where we have lots of different pathologies of work which precisely are not just characterized by this kind of devalorization or devaluation or identification. Let's just mention the precarious working relations, which are characterized by very hybrid forms, mixed situations. But not only are there two kinds of problems, it has also been shown that the relations outlined here combine different pathologies in different ways. There are typical mixed relationships of precariousness, deprivation. And now let's mention Castell, who said there was a dignification of work starting from the 19th century. And we might say that what we're experiencing right now is a dignification of the labor market, which it also comes with disenfranchisement. Now, this begs the question, alienation of work, apart from the fact of monotony and repetitiveness, how can you define it in a broader sense? How can you come up with a diagnostic spectrum which is more encompassing and which is more in line with our contemporary pathology of work? We might quite rightly say that the alienation relations which characterize the workers to the product and to their work, and therefore we should change our take on the problem. Maybe we can take a word which, instead of alienation, says that this is about the prevention of appropriation of your product, of what you do, and the prevention of participation. And this begs the question, how does quality, wealth of work relate to the question of, who dictates how work is being structured? And looking to working relations, it also becomes clear that workers always try to fight for enriching their work. They try to claim their turf for their work, regardless how blue-collar work how much blue-collar work they do or white-collar work they do. There is much more lifeblood in work than seems apparent at first view if you just look at the qualification level. There is a French work psychologist and analyst, Christophe Dujour, who always said that work is or contains an abyss between what you aim for and an abyss of what is realistic or what you can actually realize. And that characterizes the work process and the way in which you bridge this abyss, which is always there. You can also see this if you look at the arts and crafts things, which we just saw in the films here. There's always the possibility of failing. There's always a kind of abyss or near abyss, which creates a resistance to what you want to achieve. You need to fight against this resistance in order to come up with your product. And this involves, as a precondition, creative appropriation processes. And I think this is something which not only occurs when the carpenter, for instance, deals with a, you know, an irregularity in the wood, or when the rasp suddenly drifts and you have that mark in the wood. So these glitches which you need to iron out, but you always have this kind of resistance in service relations. Let's take the cloakroom workers in libraries, for instance. Even there, you've got certain resistance which you need to overcome. Here, the customer might be, well, you may say this is a low-skill, low-brow work, and it doesn't provide a lot of scope for identification. But if you look at the way in which people work, then you see this theory debunked. People try to identify with the work. They try to handle what can be planned, to handle what actually happens, and that really dictates their work. When I say enriching their work, increasing their turf, to use a very specific example, I mean cloakroom workers at the West Berlin State Library. And if you look at the jokes, the puns, banter going on there, that certain regular users are assigned certain positions, that they're always given certain stamps for their coats, etc. And then sometimes things go wrong and people get their hackles up because of this. But this is indicative of the fact that there is the inherent aim to enrich work. I'm not saying that this is a good or a bad workplace, but it's almost a desperate attempt to kind of appropriate any kind of activity which you engage in. And that begs the question. Work is very normatively charged in our relation, in our society. And it makes perfect sense to think about ways in which these relations should be created in order to facilitate this in a decent way. So this is a pivotal problem, and actually this becomes clear very much by the example I just gave you. Now let's move on to the mezzanine level, or the stepping stone I mentioned in my introduction. That's something that was mentioned this morning, Dietrich Dietrichsen. And then I shall move on to the second part of my presentation. My theory, or my answer, is that we should see work as a possibility to participate in a public pool of resources beyond the proposition that the appropriation conditions of work relations should be investigated in order to gain a grip on more comprehensive working relations. But beyond that theory, I would also propose that it makes sense to understand work as a collaborative effort and a social practice. And when we put the question, what is successful working relations and what is unsuccessful working relations, should be gauged under this premise. Let me give you the rationale for this. And maybe we can discuss this later on. What do you see if you see these different shots on labor? What is it you see? We spent the entire morning, or actually the entire day up until now, without actually questioning whether it is actually work, what you see here. But Werner Prinert, in his introductory or keynote address this morning, he said fleetingly that you didn't see the economic aspect. And this was also reverberating in various presentations. We don't really know which kind of context all of this takes place. What is before? What is after? And, you know, it's to do with the various countries and the definition of working relations, etc. Actually, I would take this reverberation one step further. We don't see at all that it is work or what kind of work it is, at least not if you zoom in and if you ask yourself, what is work as a specific activity? Activity, and how far is work different from other activities? Somehow you know this, but In a way, you only know this because you bring the background along yourself, because you see a carpenter work or you see a copying machine for CDs, and automatically, based on our prior knowledge, we think of the economic aspect, i.e. the exchange of resources in a public context. We take it that the CDs are not just being produced or copied so that the stack grows, and we automatically insinuate that the shoes are being repaired because they're broken, and there's somebody who pays for them because they want to wear them again. And we also assume that this is part and parcel of a social exchange of services, because people who do this won't do this for free. But you don't see this. This is your inherent knowledge. And something that was mentioned this morning too was that in the image where the Mexican little boy learns how to pick corn, he said, "I don't know whether this is work. I couldn't see this." And maybe this was most conspicuous there, that you have lots of things which you can't see. I'm just mentioning this in order to get the following point across. We don't really know what work is. You know, from an anthropological general point of view, you say, for instance, work is instrumental work, but we've got lots of work which is not instrumental work, but toil or labor. I mean, work is to do with labor, but we know lots of activities like raising children, which is labor, but it's not work. And there are lots of pointers, for instance, which indicate that that work or hobby pianists have a different activity. Or actually can't be differentiated from a professional musician. So they only get their meaning from the meaning for the exchange of goods. Or a more banal question, are they being paid for what they're doing? So what's the difference between somebody who plays the piano as a hobby and as a profession? And this brings me to the following proposition. Maybe we should define work as a social practice, the sociology of work, seeing work as a factor in social cooperation contexts in a very broad sense, as part of a social exchange of performance or social practice in these kind of cooperation contexts. Because conversely, I think there's no easy way out here, and you can't just say, well, you're just referring to gainful employment. I mean, we're not just talking about gainful employment, and work can also be work without being gainful employment. Maybe we should do this in a very broad sense, and therefore come up with a very general anthropological working definition. We could say work is a social practice, and this is indicated by the fact that it's visible as work, and it can be identified if we have follow-up practices within the meaning of what happens before and after, i.e. who gets what, tit for tat, who does work in return for what. You may need this because it also describes what we see when we see working processes. It's a mix of implicit knowledge, explicit knowledge, different habits, and certain instrumental and deliberate activities. Having said that, this also brings home the historicity of these practices. I mean, the question is, when is work a social practice? Everything that's related to this. And now this brings me to the motive of the troubleshooting process, which was mentioned at the beginning here. In how far, which role does it play as a troubleshooting approach in the social development? Now let's skip a few pages and move to the second part of my presentation, i.e. my theory. Let me do this very quickly. My theory is the following. Work should be defined as participation in the public pool of resources. And based on this, we should see deficitary work relations as a form of preventing such participation. This is based on a kind of concept which we see at Marx and Hegel, i.e. that work is a kind of educational process, or to use Hegel's words, that work as education is something that underpins the idiosyncrasy of the individual, making them capable of cooperation. And this also is based on an underlying tenet, which is expounded by Marx, that work is an activity which does not only transform the material, not just produces material products, but whilst work is producing the material product or forming nature, also changes the worker, changes their skills. And they are stored in these skills are stored in the educational process as which work qualifies here. And if Marx says that the hand is not just the organ of work, but that it's also the product of work, then this also goes to show that the work not only changes the environment and the material work, but that work also changes the worker. So based on the foregoing, work as a twofold formation process, we can now come up with a theory that work also creates sociology, creates society. And last but not least, work as the participation in public resources. Let me quote Hegel. So there's a mutual dependence of work where in this dependence and reciprocity of work and the satisfaction of the need, the subjective self-serving attitude suddenly becomes a contribution towards satisfying the need of all others, so that everyone acquires for himself, produces, and enjoys, thereby facilitating the enjoyment, production, and acquisition of others. This necessity, which is inherent in the comprehensive entanglement of the dependence of all others, is now for each and everyone the permanent resource, which harbors for him the possibility to participate by virtue of his or her education and skill in order to be secured for his or her subsistence. Just like the person themselves maintain and nurture the public resources by virtue of their work-mediated acquisition. Now, what's so important here is the interesting twofold sense of the word assets or resources. Well, assets or resources here, or pool of resources, is not just the wealth of society, but also the pool of resources qualifies or designates also the capacity of society. The capacity in terms of technical skills of society, the capacity to produce wealth over a longer development period. So it's a kind of heritage. It's this global pool of the public pool of resources is something that is a heritage, which is the repository of the skills of previous generations. And the worker who participates in the resources at the same time also creates this public pool of resources. So it's a co-creator. Well, I'm slightly behind schedule. Therefore, suffice it to mention that this twofold sense is really pertinent here. So it's about the public resources, the achievement, the public achievement, and that it's about the fact that the worker contributes to this in a way which is not, dedicated. There is no vocation. So be it precarious work, be it the exclusion from the working societies, all of these are different ways of preventing this participation in the public pool of resources. Thank you very much for your kind attention.